And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a Tuesday afternoon where I am joined by one of my most frequent guests, my first ever guest for the first time in a long time, actually. Mr. Kevin Arnovitz is here. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well. How are you?
So let's review. The last time we did a podcast together was in March, early March, at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics / Viral Fest in Boston, and we were podcasting about Kenny Atkinson getting fired. Remember that, or mutually agreeing to part ways? Was it a mutual? We need to have an acronym for that. The BS mutually agreed to part ways. Wow, that was a long time ago. It seems like
the quaint days of March when it was what seven seed positioning in the West in mutual firings, and I don't know whatever else we were talking about in March.
Somebody mentioned to me on a phone conversation the other day, where do I think Reggie Jackson is going to fit in the Clippers postseason rotation? And I was like, dude, I just forgot that Reggie Jackson was on the Clippers. So like, until you just said that, so the answer is I don't know. I have to go back and read what I wrote 4 months ago. So here we are. It's Tuesday. The NBA, as we are taping this, has not yet sent the allegedly 125-page healthcare protocols for the Orlando bubble / campus environment. Kyrie Irving and a number of other players have expressed, I don't know quite what the right word is, concern about going and a desire to perhaps step back and not go to focus on social issues and racial justice and other things like that. Other players are concerned about just being quarantined and the social isolation of that, being away from family for 45 days until the first round is over. I still think it's going to happen. Almost everyone I've talked to in the league, agents, players, coaches, GMs, league people, are optimistic it's going to happen, minus some number of players who choose not to go. And to me, this is a pretty cut and dry issue. If you don't want to go, I don't really even care what your reason is. Don't go. Like it should be a very personal choice, because if you're scared of the virus, that's legitimate. If you're scared of the mental health consequences of being isolated from your family, that's legitimate. If you want to continue to protest in Black Lives Matter movement and for social justice and racial equality, that's, I don't even know what the word for that is. That's so much more than legitimate. Like, do that. I don't have any particularly strong feelings about, like, that's pretty simple to me, right? Like, where are you on this, on the bubble in Orlando right now?
An identical place. You should, if for whatever reason you do not want to go, be it health, be it mental health, be it your commitment to activism off the court, you should not go and you should not be penalized. And I think you should also not be stigmatized. I don't want to hear, oh, he's soft, or he's letting his teammates down in a championship drive. I think we stigmatize soft and competitive in different ways, and I think simplistic ways. So you shouldn't have to go. You shouldn't be penalized monetarily or by way of stigma.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I do think it will be interesting to see if any of the key players on the six best teams decide not to go, because at that point, the NBA still goes forward with it. I mean, if LeBron doesn't go, which is not going to happen, LeBron is by all accounts going, then it becomes a different thing. But if any of those key players on LA, Milwaukee, Boston, Toronto, maybe Philly, maybe like Denver, Houston, just because of the star power on Houston, if any of those guys bow out, and I have not heard any, and I'm talking key players, like Dwight Howard was a fantastic reserve center for the Lakers this year. The Lakers can move on without Dwight Howard if he chooses not to play. Ditto with Avery Bradley, although their depth starts to get hit a little bit. But if the key players on those teams don't come, then the sort of looming asterisk, gimmicky, is this the real NBA playoffs, begins to sort of emerge as a real thing. But if guys on Phoenix, or if guys on anyone in like the seven and below range don't come, I just think it's like, I don't think that really takes away from the event so much if like Devin Booker decides not to come. You know what I mean? Like Phoenix is not going anywhere anyway.
The thing I'm most interested about are going to be the health protocols. And I have no doubt that the league will come up with something very tight, very specific protocols for various contingencies. And the Players Association will eventually agree to them. The question to me becomes, like, for instance, let me give you a scenario, Zach. 4-5 matchup, round one, series tied 1-1. in the day prior to game three, player A on the four seed tests positive for the coronavirus. There will be a protocol. It will, I don't want to speculate. It might be that, he is obviously put in quarantine. The show goes on. What I've heard from various people I've talked to is that there really isn't much flexibility to delay a game a day. But let's, for argument's sake, say, they've got some flexibility, though that runs counter to my best intelligence. But here's my question. If the protocol is and the show goes on, what happens if on the five seed players B and C say, look, I'm not comfortable taking the floor tomorrow night? I know protocol says we go ahead, but frankly, I resent having to choose between my state of mind and my comfort and frankly, life and death the way I see it. And well, whatever the players association agreed to. And then I'm put in a position where, and I mentioned this before, if I don't play, I'm letting my team down. I suspect that person wouldn't face economic consequences, but this to me is what I want to know. Like, they can come up with protocols, but when the rubber hits the road in a situation like that, what happens? What if another player on the team on the four seed says, my teammate contracted a positive infection result, and I don't want to play. Enough for me. Emmis, I'm done.
I haven't considered that scenario as much as I've considered the one that everyone's most interested in, which is the team outbreak. And your scenario is actually, as I think about it, obviously quite pressing. And I think you said something like, they wouldn't be economically penalized.
Or would they?
Well, I think they might be in the same way as if you choose not to go to Orlando at all, in the normal NBA, if you refuse to play, you can get fined. You can get punished. You're in breach of contract. It opens up. Right now, they're just saying, it's fine if you don't go. You're not going to get punished, but you're not going to get paid as you would have had you played those games. And so I would assume that the scenario you're talking about is the same. You go and you grow uncomfortable and you decide not to play one game, two games, all the remaining games. You are just treated the same way. It's like, you're not going to get paid for the games that you sit out. Is that fair? Is that not fair? I don't know. That would be my guess, but I haven't considered that.
Right. But I think they would have a case that, a fair labor case. Like, you're telling me I have to choose. I'm not lending a value judgment. I am not an epidemiologist. I am not obviously a player, but these are questions I have that I think there isn't necessarily a protocol to address them, or there is a protocol to address them. And yes, the PA might sign off on something, but we're already seeing there's a diversity of opinion, and you have to account for that purely optically. I mean, look, I think there will be serious conversations on networks like ours saying, does player Y have a case? Is it fair for player Y to have to choose between his livelihood and protocol? To say nothing of, are you letting your team down? And I think those are conversations that, while we won't be having them, I certainly, think will be happening privately among that team. And those are interesting contingencies. I think I haven't heard enough about it. In defense, I think the league is proceeding very deliberately. They're one thing at a time. But I'm curious to see what happens when the rubber hits the road.
Okay, so a couple of things. Think about the wide spectrum of players that are going in terms of financial, career, family situations, all the parameters. So you have players. There are several players. I'm not going to name them, but I know some of them. There are several players whose wives or significant others are going to have children sometime during the Orlando bubble. And they're like, well, am I really going to miss the birth of my first child to go quarantine and lose in the first round or the second round? Like, that, you have pending free agents, and everyone focuses on the guys Woj wrote about, the guys that are up for extensions, Jason Tatum, Donovan Mitchell. I mean, those guys are going to be fine. I think of a guy like Davis Bertans, who's in line for the first huge paycheck of his NBA career. Now, again, we don't know what the cap situation is going to be now. That huge paycheck could be up in thin air for all we know. On a team that is ninth in the East by 1,000 games, and their absolute best case scenario, somehow get into a play-in tournament with Orlando or Brooklyn, win, and get bulldozed by the Bucks in the first round and then go home. And I'm like, and just to get into the play-in tournament, the Wizards are so far behind, they have to go, like, let's say 6-2, or I can't remember what the math is. They have to do really well in the 8 regular season games. They go 0-2 in their first two games. I don't know who their first two games are against. If I'm Davis Bertans, I am completely without any guilt at all being like, you know what? I kind of turned my ankle in that second game. I don't think I can go for the last six. And I do wonder what life starts to look like for teams that are on the outside of the playoff picture and they lose their first two or three games. Teams that are down 0-2 in the first round with no chance to win. I wonder what life starts to look like for those teams, because I would not blame Davis Bertans. I'm just using him as a placeholder. One iota for being like, you know what? I turned my ankle. Like, I gotta get out of here and go home.
I think we're not, and again, I don't say this as a matter of criticism. I just think we're not looking at these various human factors carefully enough. I'm curious to see, just as you said, I mean, we talked about the mental health. Generally speaking, I think humans work better when they're happier. That's not to say there aren't players who play great angry, or the less comfortable I am, you know, you create adversity for yourself. God, we just watched a documentary about this. But I'm curious to see that after 6 weeks, forgetting the fitness issue and the guys have been inside and all that, I'm curious to see how this weighs upon the psyche of these players. I know to the average fan, oh, poor players, they have to stay in a luxury hotel. Now, it's not, this is a major departure from standard operating procedure, and I don't care
Also, the first 45 days, your family's not there, and your friends aren't there. Everyone's like, oh, they've been quarantining this whole time. The critics are like, oh, they've been quarantining this whole time. What's more quarantine? Well, they've been quarantining with their kids and their wives and whoever. Like, now they're going to quarantine alone for 45 days, which to me, the first half is more fraught. Viral issues aside, like, we'll see what happens to the virus in Orlando. We'll see who gets it, who doesn't get it, whatever. Just from a mental health standpoint, the first half is more fraught to me than the second half. Because if I get through the first 45 days, that means I'm on a good team and I have a chance to win. I have a chance to go really far and maybe win the title. And I can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel. And that hotel room next to me that was occupied by the Suns or the Wizards or the Kings or whoever is now open up for some of my loved ones to come over. It's the first 45 days where I'm like, I'm on team X. I got no chance. I got to do what for 45 days? I got to do this? Like, this is stupid. What am I doing here?
Yeah. The second 45 days, I think the Tom Hanks Castaway factor sort of takes in, right? Like, you've been deprived of everything. You build this new civilization. You actually get really strong. And, you know, the end is in sight. At the end of the day, you're paying for a championship. There's a certain point at which the stakes maybe overtake the discomfort. But you're right. Like, the first 45 days with just, again, the probabilities versus the disparity in comfort is an impossible negotiation.
And in terms of social justice, which is far more important than any of this that we're talking about, to me, that's a decision for any player to make. And you've seen Michelle Roberts, according to Woj and Ramona, has mentioned the sort of power of the John Carlos, Tommy Smith fist at the 1968 Olympics and opportunities to do things like that. And I know some players, I've been talking to some players who are contemplating some pretty dramatic stuff if they go to Orlando. And I shouldn't say any more than that, but there are a lot of players who feel like, look, these guys are all smart. They're all engaged in these issues. You put X hundred of them together in Orlando, they're going to come up with some things that are memorable, powerful, symbolic, emotional, at a time a month from now when maybe the actual on-the-street protests have petered out a little bit and the movement needs a little bit of a jolt. There are ways for them to do that. And everyone's going to focus on the kneeling and the anthem. And if the NBA actually tries to enforce the anthem rule, I just can't imagine that would be the case. If a player wants to kneel, let them kneel. I would hope the NBA will let them do that. But that's thinking of the one right in front of you, the one we've all been talking about. These guys will come up with some stuff that is way higher concept and more powerful and more symbolic and more and involve many more people. The opportunities are going to be there, but again, that's up to a player. If a player wants to go that route, that's fine. If a player says, I don't want to go to Orlando and protest as part of me performing basketball for a bunch of white governors, you know, mostly white governors, I want to be at home and in the streets with my family, like, that's fine too.
Yeah, I don't know what I bring to this conversation, but if I'm looking at it dispassionately, I'd say this, and Mark Spears wrote a really strong piece for the Undefeated. But
that's right. I should have mentioned Mark's piece. Yeah. It was a very good piece.
You know, having the attention of people has never come with more power, right? Because everyone is watching everything all the time, and you can leverage that attention as a social and political tool. Like, the talent and dedications of these NBA players mean that millions and millions of people from around the world will be watching them for weeks at a time. And they have an extraordinary opportunity to impart their message and inspire those viewers and generally raise the level of consciousness about the issues they care about. And they can choose to do that in a number of ways. I mean, you mentioned some symbolic things. Look, for instance, they can tell broadcasters, if I am selected for a post-game on-court interview, assuming such a thing exists, like, there's going to be at least one question that is going to address the issue at hand. Hey, by the way, we'll provide you with that question. Same thing with a press conference. The NBA players,
by the way,
say,
I can go one further than that. I know that there are players who are thinking about mentioning the names of black people recently killed by police in every answer they give in some context in a post-game interview, that's one way to do it.
Here's another idea. The postseason, in fact, the regular season, they're going to be down there for like 2.5 months. That's, 70 days? 70 organizations that you – tonight is about – I don't know, a voting rights initiative in Georgia, where 55 years after the Voting Rights Act, we're still dealing with this ridiculousness, as we saw last Tuesday. You know what? Tonight is about a rural health initiative in Alabama, where, by and large, there are counties, majority black counties, that literally don't have a cardiologist, that don't have basic health services that you would see in certain third world countries, right? Tonight is about X initiative. Right. Tomorrow night is about a criminal justice reform measure in the state of Illinois, Chicago, blah, blah, blah. Like, you, I mean, this is where it's not about disagreeing with players who might feel otherwise, but I just feel like there are very few people in the world that by virtue of their talent can command the attention of people on a nightly basis. NBA players, because of the work they've done over the course of their careers, demand that. And that to me is you could have 70 initiatives. Really important nonprofits around the country. I'm all for symbolic gestures and that they bring important media and important attention. There are also some organizations that day in and day out desperately need resources to provide, to get someone who's 75 miles from a hospital. There was a great New Yorker piece a couple months ago about, just how underserved Alabama is. And I mean, there are good people in that state day in and day out, who are trying to just pushing the rock up the hill to equalize this.
Well, to the voting rights stuff. I mean, you know, I have loved ones who have worked on that at various organizations and told me, you know, it showed me the literature and showed me stories about, you know, people who don't have driver's licenses because they don't have a car and they're, you know, they have medical issues or whatever. They can't get to a DMV. It's 60 miles away, blah, blah, blah. And the gerrymandering and all that. But I think that's a good point. And the players, the talent is irreplaceable. The players have leverage right now. It's easy to say that the players do not have as much leverage as they seem to because of what's looming on the other side, which is if they decide not to play, the owners are going to rip up the collective bargaining agreement. There's going to be a lockout and the new CBA will presumably be less friendly to players. But I got news for you. The owners don't want to do that. And this is a financial disaster for them too. And they really would like to play this season and recoup the hundreds of millions of dollars that are sitting there. They would really like to find a way to play next season. They don't, even though they have more resources than the players, they do not want to go a year and a half without basketball, even if the other side of it is a CBA where they get 5 percentage points more of basketball related income than they do now. So I do think the players have leverage right now in this moment. And you're seeing it. The real inspirational stuff is the college guys who are saying, I don't want to go back and play football for your school. If you have this freaking Confederate slaveholder's name on this building, like they have power. Like the talent is irreplaceable. It'll be interesting to see how it all comes out. I still think we're playing. The health protocols will be interesting and comprehensive. And, you know, it just, at some point we'll all know, right? Like at some point this will not be speculation anymore. We'll all know. And I think we're ready for that point. Nominally, this is not why I had you on to do this podcast, but it's just too interesting to talk about. I had you on because we both picked our, I guess, tentative all-defensive teams. I don't know. These are like almost final. These 8 games are, they count, but they don't count that much for awards purposes. I mean, in the percentage of the season. And I love all-defense. It's one of my favorite awards to do. There are so many different stats you can look at, but at the end of the day, it sort of just comes down to how those stats interact with what you saw on film. And unlike all NBA, you only get 10 spots. You get a first team and a second team. Two guards, two forwards, two guards, two forwards, and a center on both teams. The degree of positional flexibility we will have is TBD until we get the ballot for some of these players. I err on the side of urging the league to give me maximum positional flexibility to get the players I want on it. I thought this year was a particularly tough year with lots of good candidates. Some of the mainstays maybe, I think, weren't as good as they are in typical years, and that opened up some spots. And I still have a spot that's kind of undecided that you can sway me with if you want. Let's start with our first team guards. I will yield the floor to you. You can proceed any way you like, but first team guards, who you got?
Yeah, and I just want to say, I too want to kind of think out loud for some of the second team guys and want your input. For the first team guards, I'm set. And I am selecting Marcus Smart and Kyle Lowry.
Ooh!
Okay, let's start with Smart. He not only contains the ball, he's phenomenal with his hands.
What a compliment to give a man phenomenal with his hands.
I mean, it's just, it's incredible. Like, he is just, I can't imagine one possession on the ball. I mean, let's set aside side, I mean, among guards, that I'd less want to go against if it were a possession of consequence. I mean, it's just the containment. And it's funny, he's such a brute force and it's scrappy, but there's actually a great deal of finesse to his defense too. Anticipation. And I just love watching him play defense. Lowry's interesting because usually a guy who, when he's older, you know, might lose a step. And by the way, we talk about losing a step offensively. You know, guys lose a step defensively too. It doesn't just work one way. The gamesmanship, we obviously know about the taking of charges. He might also be the best off-ball defender at guard on a team, by the way, that's very help-oriented. The help mentality is amazing. Obviously, the toughness we talk about. He's always the next guy on that team, right? Like, that's part of the, you know, the funny is we see the charges that are drawn and when there's contact and there's a collision. What you don't see are the number of times where that presence, just by virtue of that presence, as the next guy up in a defensive scheme where you just kind of blunt the attack. I mean, how many plays a game, like, does he stop the ball? It's incredible. And I just feel like, I'm putting Lowry, and there are some other guys that I'm considering for second team who are all great, but I'm comfortable with this pick, and those two guys are who I have.
So my first team, we share one in common, and that's Marcus Smart. Marcus Smart is a no-brainer to me. I don't even need to defend the pick. He's a first team all defense level player. He's on the team. I don't have Lowry on my first team. We'll talk about him in context a little bit later, but I mean, he has a case. It's not because he doesn't have a case. He led the league in charges drawn. He is, as you said, one of the smartest off-ball defenders in the entire league. And that team functions on IQ and and positioning. And Lowry epitomizes that more than almost anyone on that team, maybe other than Marc Gasol. I think I had a difficulty with there's this school of guys, so I'll put three guys in this school of defenders, because I thought of them similarly. Kyle Lowry, Chris Paul, and LeBron James. And what they share in common is their head-to-head matchup is often one of the weaker players, if not the weakest player on the other team. Toronto is afforded that luxury with Van Vliet and the versatility of Anunoby and Siakam. LeBron just punts all the tough assignments. And CP, because he plays with Shea Gilgeous-Alexander and often Dennis Schroeder, they put him off the ball on some of the weak spot-up guys. But their value in that role as helpers, as rovers, as communicators, as guys who can switch onto the lead ball handlers late in possessions is enormous. And so it was hard for me to sort of weigh those guys against the guys that can do all the things I just talked about off the ball, but also start every possession on either the other team's point guard or like the best player on the other team. So that's why I didn't have Lowry on first team. He's definitely in the conversation for one of the four guard spots to me. My other first team guard And this gets me into positional issues, although I'm confident this guy is A, unclassifiable. You can't classify him by position, really. And B, was classified as a guard for essentially every award last season, every kind of award. And that's Ben Simmons. So my first mm-hmm. my first team all defense guards were Marcus Smart and Ben Simmons. And I think Ben Simmons is, do I need to defend this pick? The guy guards five positions. He had a stretch of the season where he was like Deion Sanders closing games with interceptions and stuff like this. Like he was crunch time steals, and just was a ferocious defender the entire year. I guess if you could have a knock on him a little bit, it's that the Sixers defense suffers a bit when he plays without Embiid. That's the case for everybody on the Sixers, even Tybalt, who is a candidate for one of these spots as well and is the best defensive rookie I've ever seen since Kawhi Leonard, maybe even better. But I just think Simmons had a fantastic defensive year. The numbers are all there. I'm a sucker for versatility. Having a guy that can guard literally every position just affords you so many luxuries of, you can have a weaker defender on the floor because you can put him anywhere. And you can, it just allows you all sorts of different lineup constructions. All right. Before we get to the rest of the first team, I think it's better if we just go by, it's smoother if we just go by position. So let's go to our second team guards. Again, you only get four slots. It's a crowded league. There's like 30 good candidates for these positions. You only get four. Simmons and Smart for me so far, Smart and Lowry for you. I had one guy, I had three guards to me that stood out above the rest that were like absolute stone cold locks for three of the four spots. Simmons, Smart, and a guy that I'm going to name in a second. I'm curious if you have this same guy on your team. So please reveal your second team guards.
Before we do that, let me indulge me a quick rundown of honorable mention. Just quick. I'm not going to do qualities or anything else. Guys I want to recognize. Jrue Holiday, Chris Paul, Fred VanVleet. And I have a special spot for if he played more. And that's Michael Carter Williams. That's an if he played more. Then I get to the tough part. I've got four guys that I really want to consider, and I think one of them is a slight notch below the other three, and that would be Patrick Beverley, who needs no introduction.
He was not my lock, and is in fact. Yeah. So I'm gonna wimp out a little bit. Well, my fourth spot is written in pencil, not pen.
Yeah.
He is a candidate for that fourth spot, but he's not written in pencil.
Right.
He's not the guy right now.
Yeah, and that's the case for me. So the guys, the three to make two for me are Eric Bledsoe, Ben Simmons for all the reasons you've cited, and Danny Green. I'll start with Green. This guy is so solid. I don't know if there's a guy who knows personnel better. He's still the best transition defender in the league, not named Giannis Antetokounmpo or one of the chase down menaces, right? And that's really important, especially given the trends that the league's gone in. Like, just having a guard who knows how to stop the ball or fan out to the right position is just, three times a game I see this. I don't know how many points it saves. Someone more advanced than me can defend that. He's lost a little bit of a step in the sense that I see more blowbys, and that might be what checks him off the list.
That's exactly, so what you just said is why he's not on my short
list. Right. And I think he's probably the odd man out, which would leave me in my second team with Eric Bledsoe, top three or four statistically consistently as a pick and roll defender. Milwaukee demands a lot, and you and I have talked about this incessantly, kind of Bud's general allergy to switching, and he just demands everybody fight through every screen. There is no handing off. There's no late defense. It's incredible what Bledsoe's put together, and he's always had sort of the skills and strength. But we've seen him in the last couple seasons as an on-ball defender, fighting through stuff. It's pretty impressive. And then I think it's going to be Simmons for me for all the reasons you cited, most prominently that versatility. What he allows them to do is really powerful. And you must be able to, given the diversity of offenses in the league that you face, the idea that there's never a game plan where you're screwed because you have Simmons, you can deploy him in any different way. So I'm going to go with Bledsoe and Simmons, with apologies to a guy I'm leaving off, Danny Green, for the first time in a while. But damn, he's good.
So interestingly, my third stone cold lock had to be on the team. Almost put him on first team. Thought he might have been the single most impactful guard on defense in the entire league this year. Did not make your short list. And that's Chris Dunn.
I have Chris Dunn. He's amazing. He's on my if he played more team.
I think he played enough. The knock on his resume was going to be he's a backup. And I do think, and this is why a guy like Tybull isn't going to make it for me. I do think it matters starter versus backup, just the quality of the opposition that you're defending. Even as rotations get more staggered and sophisticated and all the lineups are kind of hybrids, I think it matters. But Dunn, due to injury, ended up starting 32 games. He guards every perimeter position. I mean, he was effectively the Bulls starting small forward at points. I believe he led the league in steals per 36 minutes and without sacrifice, without gambling, without, I mean, that guy was the most ferocious in your jersey, absolute, you do not want to dribble the ball around him if you're a subpar ball handler, in the passing lanes, just everywhere all the time. I thought defensively, and I really admired his season because the Bulls clearly gave up on him as their starting point guard of the future, and with good reason. Like, he's just not good enough offensively. They signed Satoransky, they draft Kobe White. He's not a part of their plans. He's in trade rumors from before when the season starts. Could sulk, could gun for stats with his next team in mind. Instead, triples down on what he's good at and is like, you know what? I'm leaning all the way into being a stopper. I want to be the best defensive guard in the entire league. And I think he might have been. To me, he's a little less versatile than Smart and Simmons and the minutes and the fact that he was a backup for half his games. I put him on second team. But for me, he had to be on one of my teams. I thought he was that, and nobody watched the Bulls this year. I get it. You watched the Bulls. I know that. But I just thought he was spectacular. His defense was the most fun thing to watch about the Bulls this season, other than maybe Jim Boylan's comic late game timeouts. So that leaves me a second spot. Right now, written in pencil, is Drew Holiday in my second spot, which is tough because the Pelicans were a really bad defensive team for most of the season. A few points better with Drew Holiday on the floor. And then you just start looking at the advanced numbers, and they're off the charts. Like, all the stuff on the tracking data in terms of, like, he's one of the best in one of the ranks near the top of the league in players shooting below expectations when he's guarding them, smothering, like, some minuscule points allowed against isolations, good pick and roll defense, leads the league in deflections, the versatility I love to guard two, sometimes three, sometimes even four positions, can switch on to power forwards. I thought he had an even better defensive season than he did last year when I believe he made it. So I have Drew Holiday written in pencil. The guy that I expected going in to make one of these teams for me and did not so far is Bledsoe. I don't really know why. His activity numbers are a little bit down in terms of, like, steals and blocks. But I thought he was fantastic all year. I thought for sure I would have him on the team. His tracking numbers are great. His other adjusted plus minus numbers are mediocre, surprisingly so. I just think and Beverly and Lowry were the other guys that I felt bad leaving off for reasons that you've discussed sort of already. And my list of honorable mentions includes all the guys you just mentioned, Chris Paul, Gary Harris, Dante DiVincenzo. Someone on the Celtics, whether it's Tatum or Brown, has to count as a guard given the lineups they've started for a lot of the year, or could count as a guard. And I think Tatum was better than Brown this year. DeJounte Murray, I thought, kind of took a little bit of a step back. Josh Okogie, random guy I loved watching this year was De'Anthony Melton. Alex Caruso, apologies if I didn't name Gary Harris, or I already did name Gary Harris, but Gary Harris. There's a bunch of guys. But this spot came down to Drew Holiday, Kyle Lowry, Eric Bledsoe, Patrick Beverley, and Chris Paul. And I just thought Drew Holiday was a little bit better.
Yeah, Dunn was really fun. He's clearly the message is I'm going to stick in this league. It doesn't matter if just how deficient the shooting is. You're going to keep me in the league for the next 11 years by virtue of this.
Patrick Beverley, by the way, for what it's worth, number one among guards in our real plus minus stat by 1,000 miles, number two in the entire league behind Giannis. He might be the best rebounding little guard in the league ever, you know, like his rebounding numbers for a guy that's, I think, listed at 6'1 are off the charts. I don't really have a good reason to not pick him. I think these other guys are maybe a little more versatile, a little quicker with their first step, maybe. Like, you know, Patrick is starting to age a little bit, but he was fantastic. I have no good reason not to pick him. So those are my picks right now. Drew Holiday, you're fine with. You're not going to dissuade me from Drew Holiday.
No, I'm not at all.
Okay.
Well, I think there are a lot of not wrong answers here. I mean, they're just – and we've talked about it before. This is the Bermuda Triangle. We can – you know, even our a real plus minus stat at ESPN is being either refined or adjusted. We still don't know exactly how to quantify defense. We have some good metrics, but there's nothing foolproof.
I think it's hilarious that I have found a podcast partner who actually loves Kyle Lowry's game even more than I do. I always think I'm the biggest Lowry guy in the whole media, and it's like you've taken it to another level. Okay, let's go back to the first. Oh, by the way, captain of the If He Played More team, captain, and this is a deep, deep cut.
I wonder if yours is mine.
What Gary Payton Jr. did this year in limited minutes with the Wizards was like a crime. That guy is committing crimes on the court. I think he played like 400 minutes. He probably has 400 steals. I mean, I'm making that up, but the guy is just—he's just like robbing people of their dignity and the ball and their everything all the time he's on the court. He is I don't know if he can do anything else well enough to stick in the league, obviously, but defensively, that guy is as good a guard as there is on planet Earth. He is the captain of my If They Played More team.
Confession, I just haven't watched them enough, and especially past early first, early third. So
fair life decision on your part, sad life decision on my part. One of the reasons why, yeah. Anyway,
but now you've given me something to do, so this is good.
Oh, it's holy. It honestly makes me uncomfortable how good he is defensively. There's nothing realer than someone you can rely on, whether you're relying on them to make a shot in the clutch or be there when you need it most. Think about Ray Allen in the right corner against the Spurs. You knew that was going in. Think about Klay Thompson. How many threes has Klay made? I'm sorry, Oklahoma City Thunder fans, late in playoff games where you just know and you can tell the other team knows. The minute it leaves his hands, it's going in. Someone you can trust to come through in the clutch makes all the difference on or off the court. With State Farm, you get a teammate you can rely on. You get the real deal. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Let's go back to the first team because this is where it gets spicy. We've done our guards. Kevin Arnovitz, your first team forwards.
I got to tell you, all right, Giannis is in. Giannis is in. No, he does everything.
Let's make it clear. Giannis is the defensive player of the year.
Yes.
And I don't think it's close. So when you do this exercise, you look at every stat, right? Every tracking second spectrum camera stat, every pip'em and vip'em and borp and schnorp. And usually there's one schnorp or two schnorps where a player's good, 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 good. And then you get to that schnorp and oh, he's all of a sudden bad. What does that mean? Oh, that vorp and schnorp, he's not as good as the other ones. What does that mean? Giannis is good in everything. You cannot find a number where Giannis is not in the top five. And we've all watched him play. Giannis Antetokounmpo is the defensive player of the year and probably the MVP, which only two guys have ever done, Michael Jordan and Hakeem Olajuwon. And it's like, if you do that and you just quit basketball now, you just go to the Hall of Fame already. Like, that's it. Like, that's obviously a theoretical that's not going to happen. But we agree, right? Giannis is not close. It's not a close race.
It's the easiest call to make.
Okay, so Giannis, first team forward. Who's your second one?
All right, this is where I'm having trouble, and I think I know where you're going to come down. I mean, obviously Kawhi needs no introduction. He doesn't stop fighting through screens. He is the best perimeter get-back-in-the-play player I've ever seen, right? The chase downs, everything else, the sheer strength, the hands we've talked about for years. That's where I'm leaning. And the next guy is still in the conversation for me for first team because, and I know there are these weird plus minus, and I give a lot of credence to it, but I've seen a ton of Lakers basketball this season, and Anthony Davis is really good. Zach, he's really, really good, both as an individual defender, his reaction coming off the ball to alter shots, his awareness is leaps and bounds sharper than it ever was years ago. You can't post him. Not that there's a lot of that going on.
By the way, you know who might not be able to post him anymore?
Who?
I cannot get behind skinny Nikola Jokic. I can't get behind it. I'm alarmed. I'm worried. I don't understand what's happened. Isn't there a happy medium between early season Nikola Jokic and this svelte hipster going to clubs in Belgrade or something? Like, what happened? What happened to my Nikola?
I miss the David Wells Nikola Jokic. I mean, it's just, I think there is some virtue to that. I mean, obviously a guy needs a little more speed on the floor, but you know, I can't wait to kind of see the Orlando version of this thing. It's amusing.
But in all seriousness, you know, people on Twitter started raising the question right away. Has he lost too much weight? Is this actually going to hurt him? Because a lot of his offense, first, obviously he's the best passing big man that we've ever seen, but a lot of those passes are unlocked by his post game, and his post game is both a combination of hands and finesse and of Kevin McHale style moves, and B, he's just going to mow you over, just plow you over. And if he's lost the plow you over gear against guys like Anthony Davis, who are about his height, that matters a little bit. And you can make up for it with your counters and your moves and your canniness. But people in the league, real executives and coaches, are like, I kind of wonder how that's going to play out if he stays this skinny. Now, he's still in Serbia, which means he could be eating burek and čevapi and drinking čevarica and you know.
Now you're just showing off, Zach. You're just showing off your Balkan nomenclature.
Okay. Anyway, he's clearly not a candidate for all defense, so we've gone off the rails.
But you just have to realize how foreign this is. Five words you'll never hear a gay man from Los Angeles say is, I've lost too much weight. So it's just – I just can't even conceive of this. So that's my choice. Look, there's a lot to say for incumbency.
Wait, so what's your choice? Giannis and Kawhi?
I mean, cause I'm up against Giannis and Davis, and I know there's some shorps where Anthony just hasn't been as strong. And I know, listen, we're not seeing peak Kawhi defense, and that would be my only knock is, coasting Kawhi is still on the all something team. But I'm gonna go with Kawhi. I'm gonna vote for the incumbent. With acknowledgement that Anthony is he's had a really good year. I don't care what the advance plus minus says for that team.
So I have a solution for it. Do you want to hear my solution?
Please, are you going to put him in at the second team center?
Cheat. No, I'm putting him at first team center. Cheat. Anthony Davis played 35% of his minutes or 30% of his minutes at center. The Lakers were unbelievable in those minutes. I don't really care if I do the opposite thing for all NBA purposes or whatever. I want to get the guys who deserve to be on the first team on the first team. And this gets to the crux of the matter. Because if you put an Anthony Davis at center to reward him for a phenomenal season, and my first team front court is Kawhi, Giannis, and Anthony Davis, if the NBA allows me to do that. If they don't, then I will protest and I will mount a vigorous counter argument as to why I should be able to, which I'm doing now. If you put Anthony Davis at center, that means one of Rudy Gobert and Joel Embiid is not going to make an all defensive ballot. In most years, perhaps even in this one, that would be surprising, irresponsible. I don't know. Both of those guys didn't feel quite right to me this year. Let's start with the obvious one, and that's Embiid, who missed 20-something games. And for 15 to 20 of the games he did play, looked like the spirit had kind of left him a little bit. Like he was kind of sagging. He wasn't the same emphatic, fast, everywhere presence all the time. He could summon it. You know, you could tell when he wanted to summon it, whether it was someone he just wanted to embarrass or a big moment in a game. It was there. And I thought Gobert was 5% worse than usual this year for some reason, was just not quite at the same level. Obviously, both players I described are still the two best defensive big men in the league, but I think there's enough chips in the armor with both of them this season to slide Anthony Davis at first team center, particularly when you factor in the missed games for Embiid. Now, I will say, maybe it doesn't even matter how hard Embiid tries. Or what kind of shape he's in. Because almost every statistical indicator, I mean, again, you can find your schnorps and your vorps that are not so friendly to Joel Embiid this year. But most statistical indicators scream, just this dude's presence on the court is the most important thing on defense in the entire basketball world. Just his presence. Every Sixer is way better on defense when Joel Embiid's on the floor. The opponent's shot selection with Joel Embiid on the floor is completely warped. No one even tries to go to the rim against Philly when Joel is on the floor. Obviously, he has really good defensive partners up and down the roster. That helps. But all the evidence suggests this guy is a one-man defensive wrecker, even when he is half-assing it and a little bit out of shape or whatever the case may be. I just thought, missed 20 games or whatever, half of the games he did play didn't quite look as into it as he usually is. I'm comfortable leaving one of those guys off an all-defensive team for this 1 year if it allows me to get Anthony Davis on the first team, because I think he deserves it. Now, maybe the league won't let me do that. Maybe the last 8 games I pivot or something like that. But right now, my first team front court, my first team top to bottom is Ben Simmons, Marcus Smart, Kawhi Leonard, Giannis, and Anthony Davis. What are your thoughts on what I just said about Gobert and Embiid? Who is your first team center if you stick with your current construction?
Okay. So here's the thing. I don't want to move Davis for this reason. There are two guys I really like, and actually Embiid sort of off my list this year. It's a combination of factors.
I'm so excited for who the second guy is going to be, because I have a hunch who it is, and it's someone I really, really, really want to talk about.
I think we're going to talk about the same guy. But now, do you want me to do center?
Yeah, do your first team center.
It's a little bit of a horse race this year, and I know it's not supposed to be. Rudy, obviously. Rudy Gobert. We can talk about it forever. The reaction, the closing speed, the blocks he makes when you think he's out of the play. He never takes a possession off, blah, blah, blah. But, and maybe I'm bowing to narrative a little too much, but Brook Lopez, Zach Lowe.
Yes!
Has been fantastic! Like, forget the fact that the rim protection in their base defense, forget about the multiple efforts, like the fact that he was labeled soft and like he's completely transformed his defense. Like, the feel he has for what's coming at them, like, he guards bigs that roll, he's in coverage, he'll close out to the pick and pop big. Like, if you and I thought we were having this conversation 5 years ago, we'd laugh ourselves off the podcast. There are nights when he is the best center in basketball, even apologies to Gobert. Now, I think Gobert is my first team guy, but Brook is ridiculously good. And if you didn't carry with you the perception of years past and you came down, and you were Rip Van Winkle and you watched, you know, 3 weeks worth of games around the league, like, tell me you wouldn't have Brook Lopez as a top two center defensively.
I'm so excited that you brought him up, because he's right there with Embiid for me, where if I have a second team center, if I slide Davis to forward and have two traditional centers, he's right there for me. He's everything you just said is true. He's more versatile than people give him credit for. And I just think the way we discuss Lopez, and I think you nailed it, it has to do with his prior career and his prior reputation. Because when we discuss Gobert and Embiid, we talk about a player who makes a scheme. When we talk about Lopez, we talk about him as if the scheme has made the player. And I'm not sure why that is, other than Brook Lopez's reputation preceded him into Milwaukee. So therefore, it must be that this scheme has masked his weaknesses rather than his strength has made the scheme stand up. We just don't talk about him in the same way, and it's not fair to him. His rim protection numbers are off the charts. He is more versatile. He can close to pick and pop bigs, all that. I just think, I mean, let's be real for a second. Game on the line, who do you want on the floor defensively for one possession, Joel Embiid or Brook Lopez? I still want Joel Embiid, and I still want Rudy Gobert by a hair over Brook Lopez. But he's been fantastic. If he got first team all defense, I wouldn't bat an eye. He's been that good this year.
But I don't think that's the criteria, because I'd probably have LeBron James, and we're not talking
That's very fair.
You know, given what they do, I mean, look, if Embiid was on Milwaukee, maybe we'd have a different conversation. But what Milwaukee does, I kind of want. You can't extricate a guy necessarily from scheme, you brought up this point, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with scheme making the guy. That is the demand of an NBA player. This is what we do. You need to be 105% of what this particular role requires in this particular defense. Like, that's how you win 400 games a season when you're the Milwaukee Bucks.
I found myself wanting to reward multiple Bucks and or one Raptor. I'm not going to have one Raptor on my team, which feels completely unfair.
But, it does.
You know, in my defense, I said this on with Pelton last week. I pulled a bunch of coaches wanting to get a Raptor on the team. Bunch of opposing coaches say, who's the best defensive player on the Raptors? Just give me the single best guy What do you think the most common response was?
I mean, I've had the same poll, and maybe we talked to different guys. I mean, Lowry's the guy every coach wants to talk about.
I heard Marc Gasol more than Lowry.
Okay. You know, fair enough. And I love Gasol's game. And the other reason, this is why I don't want to move Anthony Davis over to center, is I just want those two guys. And the truth is my second team forwards, for whatever reason, I don't know what it is. The depth is a little, there's some guys I like, but they're not perfect. And we'll talk about it. And I suspect we have many of the same guys when you're ready to do second team forward.
I can't quibble with you. I can't. I mean, if you want Brooke, he totally deserves it. I have Gobert as my second team center. I have Rudy Gobert is still the best defensive center in the league this year. He's my second team center after Anthony Davis. Let me just give you one Gobert stat. Gobert, this is according to Second Spectrum's tracking data, defended 177 isolations this year, which was like fourth most in the league. You can picture in your head what a lot of those probably are, right? Switches, late in the clock. Okay, let's go at the big fella. Average points per possession on those plays for the offense, 0.69, which is kind of like if you and I took a hook shot from, well, it's actually better than that. It's very, very bad. It's very bad. And for him to hold guards to that number, I think attests to his feet have gotten a little quicker. His ability to play the angles has gotten a little better. So even though I saw a little bit of maybe again, 5% worse than usual, I still think he was the best of this bunch this year. So I have Gobert as my second team center, along with Chris Dunn and Drew Holiday as my second team guards. You have Brooke Lopez as your second team center, I guess, right?
That is correct.
Along with who were your second team guards again? Ben Simmons and
Eric Bledsoe.
Okay, let's get to the forwards. If you don't have Anthony Davis as a first team forward, I assume he has one of your second team spots.
Yeah, and that was really easy. If they played more, Torrey Craig.
Ooh, interesting.
If they played more, Torrey Craig. I just
did not expect Torrey Craig's name to make an appearance.
Insanely competitive. Really versatile, good feet. I just look. That's not a team that should be is probably as good as they are defensively, and you know I think he has a lot to do with that as kind of a defensive fulcrum for them when he's on the floor. Doesn't play enough to warrant second team consideration. It's down to two for me.
Okay.
Pascal Siakam and Bam as a power forward.
I considered both.
I think Toronto demands a lot from their players. And he has lent them a versatility, especially when you consider sort of the stature of their two guards. Now, obviously, you know, you can't post up Kyle Lowry and they both those guys play bigger and, you know, Gasol is just so intelligent. He's sort of a wizard back there, but you know, Siakam's versatility has allowed them to do a lot. And we talk about that is what, you know, in the Simmons fashion, which is the versatility of a guy enabling flexibility and to do adjustments and to be creative. And that is the most creative defense in the league, probably. You know, Bam's Bam. I think the sheer intelligence, the sheer anticipation, he understands offenses. Like you can just see him, whether it's positioning, whether it's help, whether it's just, I mean, there are times where he will move before the offense moves. And there's a sixth sense. I don't think he's perfect. I've seen nights when like Vucevic kind of had his way with him. And that's why I'm sort of leaning Siakam, but I'm as a Bamologist, Zach, I am asking you to sort of help me determine who this last guy is.
So I had two forward spots to play with by virtue of putting Anthony Davis at center. And one of the reasons why I'm not fully committed to that construction is you just said Bam isn't perfect. Now, obviously perfect is a standard that no player is going to meet, but there are little hiccups here and there from him and from everybody that I considered for these forward spots. I mean, Draymond Green, by the way, the stats still say Draymond Green had a really good defensive season, but I think everyone agrees that he was a little bit hit or miss and missed some time. The Siakam one is interesting because that gets you into a sort of philosophical debate of almost everyone around the league agrees that Pascal's defense slipped 5 to 10% this year because of the burden he had to carry on offense. And so it just makes you ask, do I value B plus A minus defense from a guy who averages 25 points a game or 23 points a game and has to really exert himself on offense? Is that quote unquote better defense than A plus defense from a guy who doesn't have to do anything on offense and expend any energy on offense? And I think that's actually an interesting debate. And as you said, particularly at the beginning of the year, they were putting Pascal on everybody. They were just whoever the best player was on the other team, just put Pascal on him. I actually thought Anunoby had just as much of a case as Siakam. Obviously, he's a more limited offensive player, which touches on what I just talked about. He had a fantastic defense. I mean, everyone on the Raptors did. Their entire starting five is sensational defensively. It feels unfair to not have them, any of them on the team. And in some respects, they are all victims of each other's excellence because they're sort of all A-minus level to, I mean, maybe better than that, but, you sort of notice each one of them a little bit less because of how great the collective is.
Yeah. There are three guys also I just want to mention that I didn't get to do my honorable mentions. You know, LeBron.
We're going to talk about LeBron. Great.
Yeah, OG. And I've liked Royce O'Neal a lot. He's not every night. Too. You know, I really like Royce O'Neal's defensive game. And I kind of, you know, I kind of came down to Adebayo and Siakam, but there are days where I've considered these other three. And you're going to talk about these guys, then, you know, I'll let you, but you wanted to kind of mention the honorable mention guys because I enjoy doing that.
You can throw in, you know, my honorable mention list is very long, but, you know, the Rockets guys, P.J. Tucker and Covington, Tatum and Brown. Tatum's close. Tatum is really close. I thought Jeremy Grant had a great year in Denver. Millsap is always good, missed some games. Yeah. Dorian Finney-Smith is sort of an under-the-radar guy. So I had two spots to play with, and I went with two Heat guys. I went with Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo. I thought they were both outstanding this year. I don't think I need to sell Jimmy. Jimmy's a perennial all defensive candidate. I think he brought it this year. And Bam as a forward is not a stretch, even though people think of Bam probably as a center in their closing lineups. He starts at power forward. He guards stretch power forward so that Myers Leonard can hang around the rim. And again, the versatility is part of what makes him valuable. I agree. The rim protection is maybe B plus level from him. I think he'll get to an A eventually with experience, but the switchability and the isolation stats that I just mentioned for Rudy, one of the guys that actually I believe faced more isolations, one of the only guys in the league is Bam. And the numbers are just about the same, like 0.7 something points per possession allowed, just a tiny, tiny figure because of how good he is in that discrete situation. And I can hear the Raptors fans, and nobody does crazy like the Raptors fans. Maybe the Utah fans, maybe. They're a little different kind of crazy. Nobody does crazy like the Raptors fans. I love Toronto. I love the Raptors fans. How can we have nobody on either of your defensive teams and the Heat, who ranked like 13th or 14th in defense? We're second. They have two. To which I say, I have no good reason. No, there's just none. But if you look at Miami's team, Bam and Jimmy Butler are carrying the load for that team on defense, and they're carrying a lot of guys who are not good defensively, whereas Toronto has all guys who are good defensively. And so I think I can justify it a little bit by just pointing out, you know, Jimmy's the guy who's going to guard the best wing on the other team every night, and Bam is the all-everywhere, do-everything force at the rim, at the arc, and all that. Like I said, I'm not 100% committed to these picks. I could get talked into putting Anthony Davis on the second team and kicking one of these guys off, but that's my second team right now is Chris Dunn, Drew Holiday, Bam, Jimmy Butler, and Rudy Gobert.
Yeah, and you know, Bam has that Horford-esque quality out on the perimeter that I really like, and I'm sort of a weakness at. I think I'm going to go with Siakam. Just again, the demands of that defense on him are just, and I know, look, it's 5% less, but he makes it up with volume, if that makes sense. Kind of the old retail joke, but so that's kind of where I'm at. But I'm like you. Until the ballot comes, I will still continue to ask people in the league when I talk to them, and this has sort of become a routine question, is, hey, let's just take a few minutes, help me with my all defense. I want to hear those who scout these teams, who they're most afraid of. It was funny. I felt like Ford was a little less deep this year, and maybe it was just Draymond's absence. But I just feel like that's used to be a position where I just didn't have enough spaces. And for whatever reason, it was a little bit more shallow this year. They're still great defenders. I just didn't, the list didn't fill up as quickly as the guards.
So, Let's talk about the nexus of LeBron, Anthony Davis, and Kawhi. Because you have Anthony Davis as a second-team forward. I would also have Anthony Davis as a second-team forward. I think that qualifies among fans as a lukewarm take because Anthony Davis was the presumptive defensive player of the year 30 games into the season, I think. I think Kawhi was a little bit better defensively than AD this season, and Giannis was better than both of them. And you mentioned peak Kawhi versus coasting Kawhi. Sometime 20 games in, peak Kawhi came out again. And the game I remember, I'd have to look up exactly when it was. They were playing Dallas in Dallas, and he had clearly hit the San Antonio gear of like, I am going to single-handedly stop every possession, to the point that Luka Doncic, who is a top three pick and roll passer on planet Earth, who is so smart that he is used to manipulating backline defenses, he's used to tricking the help defenders, to thinking two and three steps ahead of them. He would see Kawhi in between passing lanes. Like, Kawhi's on the weak side shooter. He's coming in. He's kind of helping on the roll man, but not quite all the way there. Kind of still in touch with the weak side shooter. And you could see Luka Doncic on five or six possessions in a row being like, oh, I don't know if either of these passes are safe. I don't know what to do. And Kawhi got into peak Kawhi gear sometime in the middle of the season and stayed there. And to me, peak Kawhi is the best defensive player in basketball still. Joel Embiid, peak Joel Embiid should be the best defensive player in basketball. Maybe he is. But peak Kawhi appeared and stayed and is a terrifying, terrifying force of nature. And so I would have him ahead of Anthony Davis too. And LeBron, the numbers scream that LeBron's a candidate this year. Every yes. number. The tracking numbers, the adjusted plus minus numbers, all that stuff. I considered him, but just ultimately what I see every game is the Lakers being like, okay, Kuzma, you guard the hard guy. Danny Green, you guard the hard guy. We need LeBron to rest on defense. Now LeBron resting on defense this year was a different kind of player than LeBron resting on defense the past couple of years than the last years in Cleveland. This LeBron may not have been guarding the ball, a dangerous ball handler, but he was engaged and he was wrecking stuff around the rim and he was in passing lanes and so if you want to put LeBron on, the stats say he has a case. I think he has a minor case, but for me, again, the mix of there were enough guys who, A, both are engaged with the ball at a high level, and B, are off the ball helpers at a high level that I just couldn't get there with LeBron.
Yeah. It's fair. And again, I think, you know, an interesting drill here, Zach, would be who's your all defensive team one possession, as you say?
Yeah.
Right? Like that might be a different list. I mean, I don't actually, the truth is if you can only have two forwards, I still don't know if it's not Giannis and Kawhi.
Yeah. Giannis, Kawhi, Davis, LeBron, and like me could probably get a lot of stops. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like if you put us, and then you could put Paul George, or you want a traditional center, you put Embiid, but you start with Giannis and Kawhi and then you go from there, I think.
Yeah.
So you have okay. So that's where we are. So I went Smart, Simmons, Kawhi, Giannis, AD, Dunn, Drew Holiday, Bam, Butler, Gobert. And if the league makes me move Anthony Davis to forward, I'm sorry, AD, you're going to second team. And I have some ballot rejiggering to do. Was there anybody that you that we didn't talk about that you wanted to talk about? Was there anybody that you thought would be in the conversation and then you did a little research and were like, ooh, this guy wasn't quite where I thought he was this year?
No, I mean, it's a pretty, like, I kind of listed, went pretty deep there on my list of everybody I researched closely. But no, I mean, I think, you know, Bledsoe is an interesting one. I mean, again, there's some shoops or whatever you call them, the snorps. I'm sorry. I need to get on that. But no, I think this is it. This is a pretty comprehensive list. It's always, the only award that's harder for me is Coach of the Year, but all defense just requires more conversations, more research, like going back and watching some film, going through the second spectrum. It's really hard. Again, we don't have hard and fast criteria for this stuff. We just don't.
Well, and again, it's a very limited number of spots. So, and this happens particularly with guards, where somebody will not make it, and there will be screaming like, how can you possibly leave Eric Bledsoe off? Or how, Patrick, it's a disgrace that Patrick Beverley's, I think PJ Tucker has been the subject of that, in the last couple of years. Now, I had PJ Tucker on second team all defense last year, so I'm not guilty, but the Rockets people were, fans were, it's even some players chimed in, I think, like, it's disgraceful. Well, you only get four. You only get four forwards and you only get four guards, and you realize pretty quick, like, you know, maybe there should be a third team all defense like there is for all NBA or something, because you realize pretty fast, like, there are some guys who are super duper deserving who you just can't fit. And I'm sorry, but you can't be outraged because I tried, and you only get two centers and four. Maybe there should be three all defense teams. What do you think?
No, I would like it. I mean, because what you're talking about is that would allow you, if you considered sort of centers plus 10 other guys in the Dunn, Michael Williams, Michael Carter Williams, you know, guys who don't play enough. I mean, you're basically asking, let's say there's 70 to 75 guards who are legitimately eligible, that would still keep you in the top 10 percentile. I mean, and I think that's a distinguishing honor. And so I would totally go third team. I would appreciate third team.
I love defense. I love this exercise. So those are our teams. We have some overlap. We have some disagreement. I am going to ride hard for Chris Dunn in award season. It's interesting. You just threw Embiid all the way out of contention.
He's like the strong. He would be the third team ink billboard. It doesn't even matter, right? Like, he is on. Okay. You know, it was to me Gobert, Lopez, and Embiid. While I have appreciation for Marc Gasol, I mean, those three were my three, and I couldn't not give the honor to Brook Lopez this year. There's just, I watch a ton of them. I watch a ton of Philly too. I think I'm supposed to be with Philly during April and May. But I just, those were the three. So I know it's tough. Like, Embiid is my biggest snub, if you will.
I remain obsessed with Philly, to an unhealthy degree. I can't wait to see, what condition Ben Simmons, who is injured, and Joel Embiid, who is Joel Embiid, are in when we get to Orlando. There is some part deep in my soul, the irrational part, the part that wants to believe in Santa Claus and things like that, that still believes Philly can put it together this year. It still believes there's a championship contender lurking in the parts that have proven to be misshapen and fits that have been weird and this and that. I still can't quit them. I don't think it's going to happen. I will say they're in that Boston matchup. Let me just get in front of this preemptively. Right now it's Boston Philly, and everyone is going to throw like Philly's dominated that matchup. That matchup is bad for Boston. You know, Boston needs Philly to move into the 4-5 thing. I understand why the matchup has been bad for Boston. I understand. I don't really necessarily buy that, and I would pick Boston to win that series. If I'm Philly, I'm still, despite my success in that head-to-head matchup, I'm still trying to get into 4-5 to face Miami. I buy that they have some structural advantages that help against Boston, but I just think the Celtics are flat out a better team, and I would pick the Celtics to win that matchup despite the head-to-head records recently.
Yeah, I probably do too. I mean, to me, this is the thing I've been thinking about. When you strip away home court advantage, which will now not exist, when you consider the length of the hiatus, I mean, we're basically talking about a full off season. And I just think basketball is a momentum sport. It's not to say that if you sputter into the playoffs, you can't catch fire and teams coast and flip the switch and, you know, all that. But I just think we're going to have more parity. I think we might have two seeds losing in the first round uncharacteristically. I think we might, like, I think it is going to be, when you consider all of that, certain teams are going to have trouble recapturing their momentum. I mean, I don't care about 8 regular season games. I just think people fundamentally change over a 3.5 month hiatus. And I think we are going to see, it's going to look like it could look like an NCAA bracket where it's like you look up in the regional finals and it's an 8 versus a 2 and a 4 versus a whatever it is. Like, I think this could be just wackadoo. Look, I could be wrong. It could be a chalk playoffs as it often is in the NBA, but I just have a hunch that anything, it's just going to be crazy.
Well, we are going to see one way or another soon, including if this thing actually happens. Kevin Artovitz, it's always a pleasure to see you. I haven't seen you since Boston. I hope you're safe, stay healthy, and it's always a pleasure having you.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're feeling better.